It's Tuesday, October 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, VOA is on the ground near Mosul as Iraqi forces advance on Islamic State.
We stand ready to honor our commitments. We stand by international law, and we stand by the Philippines.
Shifting politics in the Philippines. Also ahead, is widespread fraud really possible in U.S. elections? And a new VOA documentary looks at Muslim American political candidates. It's all on today's International Edition. Iraqi forces have regained more than 800 square kilometers of territory from Islamic State since the fight to retake Mosul began last week. Pentagon spokesman Navy Captain Jeff Davis says the significant gains include Bartella, about 30 kilometers east of Mosul city center, which is now in the process of being cleared. Iraqi forces and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters have been moving through small towns to the north, east, and south of Mosul as they work their way closer to the city itself. U.S. officials caution that progress will be slow and deliberate. However, with fighting expected to intensify, the closer Iraqis and Kurds get to the city. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in northern Iraq and has been visiting areas recently vacated by Islamic State. And she tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about what she has seen.
Well, the physical destruction of the properties is just unbelievable. Airstrikes bombed out a lot of the houses. People, for the most part, fled those areas. A few people stuck around, and there's a few people going back to areas that are deemed relatively safe in terms of having not as many bombs or landmines around as other places in which the army has said stay away from. But you can see everything's a mess because you can see electrical lines have been cut everywhere. ISIS had cut off access to internet. Locals are saying that they don't have any water. Besides the destroyed buildings, there are also in one area, in the area I was at today, there are oil wells burning, and it's just everywhere you look across the skyline, it's black, black smoke. And the people are literally covered within oil residue. I saw children covered in oil residue, and the mom said, I can't wash them because we just have enough water to drink. We don't have any more water. And even water, it doesn't really get the oil residue out.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you said you were speaking to people. Most of the people that you were seeing that have been, sort of fleeing, are these families? Are these women with children? Are there men with them? I mean, who are these people?
They're mostly families. So there's men, women, and children. I spoke to today a young man who fled and came back. And while he was sitting with other young men in the street and I was talking to them, he did have a family, he did have two kids. I also met a family that stayed the whole time, and it was a wife and a husband and three children. And they stayed, and they said they barely survived it, but they didn't have any place else to go.
Well, now, the oil fire that has been, launched by Islamic State, is this on the outside of Mosul?
Yeah, it's not very far from Mosul. It's more... Rather than its proximity to Mosul, it's also just a very strategic place because it is the place the army wants to go into Mosul through. So they believe they have to take down not just Gayera, but, all of the surrounding areas before they take Mosul, which is obviously the biggest city. It's the second biggest city in Iraq, so it's a huge undertaking. So the army has cleared the city or the town of Gayera from Islamic State militants, but just 5 days ago, they were right on the edge. So they've just basically been pushed back. And the last time when they were right on the edge, they were continuing to set things on fire in the oil fields, which had been controlled by the army, but that doesn't mean there were still attacks.
VOA's Heather Murdoch in northern Iraq, and you can follow the progress as forces move closer to Mosul on our website at voanews.com. We turn now to our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me here in Studio 22, and she's here to discuss the U.S. presidential election and the uproar over...
Yoga pants.
Yoga pants. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. So here's good news for Republican candidate Donald Trump. With just over 2 weeks left until the U.S. presidential election, Trump won his first major newspaper endorsement. The Las Vegas Review-Journal tweeted they are endorsing the candidate. Dozens of other outlets, including some who traditionally back the GOP nominee, have endorsed his opponent, Hillary Clinton.
Okay, I must ask, what's the online reaction like that to the announcement?
So on Twitter, people are pointing out the link between its owner, Sheldon Adelson, and Trump. Adelson is a Republican mega donor and casino magnate who contributed millions of dollars to Trump's campaign. Now, on the side of Trump supporters, they're criticizing the fact that the endorsement came too late. His opponent already has 48 newspaper endorsements.
Wow, quite a difference. Mm-hmm. Well, in Rhode Island, I understand, there was a parade about yoga pants. What's all that about?
Yep. So if you saw photos of women parading throughout Rhode Island in yoga pants today, that's because they are protesting against a local man's discontent about women over the age of 20 wearing yoga pants. A 63-year-old man wrote to a local newspaper that the widespread popularity of the exercise attire is, in his own words, bizarre and disturbing. Someone actually tweeted, "I dare you to find a less popular opinion." Even Canadian newspapers picked up the story and tweeted one of the parade participants' complaints. That is, the women are tired of mansplaining.
Well, good thing that didn't come up in the election campaign. What else is trending?
Russian tennis player Svetlana Kuznetsova is trending because during a women's tennis tournament finals in Singapore, she broke out scissors and cut a massive chunk of her own hair and then beat her rival. So people are using the name of the tournament, hashtag WTA Finals, to talk about her unusual behavior and the win, which many found quite refreshing. So remember, if you want to win a tennis tournament, all you have to do is take out the scissor, cut your ponytails. Jim, back to you.
All right. Thank you so much, G, for that great wrap-up. In fact, we'll be talking about that particular subject on our Game Room podcast. Look for it later this week at voanews.com. You can, of course, follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and our own individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, China's anti-corruption drive forges ahead as political reshuffle looms. Residents of Kunduz in Afghanistan fear another Taliban attack. Indian police kill 18 Maoist rebels. Philippine president's pro-China shift faces a test at home. South Korea's president wants to amend constitution. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at our voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, you can check out all the latest news with our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Daniel Russell on Monday said Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's recent controversial statements have created a climate of uncertainty, especially after saying last week in Beijing he was separating with Washington. Russell met with Foreign Secretary Perfecto Yasay, after which he insisted the United States remains a steady and trusted partner.
For our part, the United States remains a steady, and I hope trusted, partner, a strong ally. We stand ready to honor our commitments. We stand by international law, and we stand by the Philippines.
Russell also said it would be a mistake to think improved Philippines-China relations come at the expense of the United States. East-West Institute analyst Gerard Finnan tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Russell's position is the correct one.
The United States relationship with the Philippines is in a bit of a transition, but at the same time, it looks like the Philippines is trying to broaden its partnerships in the region in terms of military-to-military relationships. So, for example, they're talking with Vietnam, they're talking with China, they're talking with some other Southeast Asian nations. And this may not be entirely negative if one puts the rhetoric to the side. The other thing that's clear is that Mr. Duterte went to China at a time when the International Tribunal had said China was not legally entitled to do what they had done in terms of building the islands close to the Philippines and denying Filipino fishermen access to the Scarborough Reefs. All of that, to me, suggests that what Mr. Duterte is trying to do is find some accommodation with China And that may be a good thing over the long term. But what he really came away with were two things. One, he took out some loans, some soft loans from China. Number two, he said, let's keep talking about the South China Sea. Perhaps the more important point is what's happening internally in the Philippines to the rule of law. And that's where I think one has to ask questions about the human rights issues and where they stand.
Well, you've touched on an irritant between the two countries. Russell, in fact, mentioned that. He said while the U.S. supports Manila's effort against the scourge of drugs, Washington is concerned over the loss of lives, which is not a positive trend and is bad for business as well.
Obviously, President Duterte doesn't have a positive view of the United States, but the vast majority of Filipinos have, I think, a very fond view of our nation. And as you know, there are millions of Filipino-Americans who will ensure that regardless of what happens over the course of the next 6 years during the Duterte administration, that the relationship remains strong on a people-to-people level.
University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer described Mr. Duterte's improving ties with Beijing and the, quote, separation from the United States, good boy, bad boy behavior.
The good boy is, because of the arbitral award, those two countries are the only ones that must carry it out. So at least it establishes some common ground, and the fact that Duterte's open with China ends a two-year hiatus in relations, and in my estimation, provides China incentives to be more cooperative with the Philippines and downplay militarization and downplay aggressive action by its Coast Guard. Bad boy, a small town mayor becoming president and saying nasty things about the U.S. president, waxes and wanes, where his aides have got to scurry all around the place and add explanations. And in my recent trips, I've spoken to many Philippine ambassadors and other officials, and they just say they have to wait it out. We're seeing words and hurtful words and unstatesmanlike words, but we're not yet seeing official action that informs the United States.
The Obama administration, of course, on its way out the door. What happens to the rebalance to Asia?
The rebalance could be dented by Duterte if he undermines the enhanced defense cooperational agreement that allows for the rotation of American forces. But the U.S. is still capable of maintaining a naval presence in the area and an air presence, but not with the ease it would have had in the Philippines. But the other leg, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, looks to be well and truly kicked out because of the caustic American reaction to globalization and the fact that two presidential candidates are against it. That leaves 11 countries high and dry in the region that very much wanted the TPP with the U.S.
Carl Thayer said the U.S. rebalance to Asia has a shelf life that ends January 2017, and the new U.S. president will call it by a new name. Free and fair elections have always been the cornerstone of American democracy and a standard for many around the world. So this week's comments by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump about electoral fraud have alarmed many in the United States and abroad. While experts agree there is no statistically significant electoral fraud in the United States, they do caution it's an unusual electoral year for many reasons, and problems could arise, as VOA's Jeff Swikard reports.
Following more than a week of sexual assault allegations leading to shrinking poll numbers, Donald Trump stepped up his claims that the American electoral process is rigged.
The process is rigged.
It's a rigged election.
It's a rigged system. And they take these lies and they put them on front pages.
His all-out assault on the electoral process brought condemnation from Republicans and Democrats alike, including the President of the United States.
Every expert, regardless of political party, regardless of ideology, conservative or liberal, who has ever examined these issues in a serious way will tell you that instances of significant voter fraud are not to be found.
Voting rights experts agree the electoral process is not rigged, but caution there could be other problems. This will be the first election without some of the protective provisions of the 1964 Voting Rights Act, which were struck down in a Supreme Court case 3 years ago, specifically the Federal Election Observer Program.
This is now the first presidential election cycle in more than 50-plus years where the Justice Department will not have, around the country, federal observers who are specially trained individuals monitoring elections in some of the most vulnerable parts of our country.
The Justice Department sent out more than 780 observers in 23 states for the 2012 election. This year, there will be observers in less than 5 states. 14 states will be enacting new restrictive voter laws. With no federal observers to ensure laws are implemented correctly, civil rights organizations are setting up phone banks like this one for voters to call.
Right now, we're monitoring for issues like purging of the voter registration rolls, 11th-hour efforts to change polling locations without giving voters adequate notice of those problems, efforts to target and challenge voters' eligibility to cast a ballot on election day.
Most observers agree this election has been unusual, and that will extend to the voting process on election day. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Washington.
And be sure to stop by voanews.com for more on this story and as developments continue as we move closer to our November 8th election day. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8th, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Muslims immigrating to the United States have become one of the big topics of the U.S. presidential election campaign this year, and interestingly, several new Americans of Muslim faith have been seeking elected office across the country. Reaction and support by voters has been surprising. VOA's Kane Farabaugh has made a documentary about 4 Muslim immigrants seeking various offices and joins us in the studio to tell us more about his film, Faith and Freedom: The Journey of Muslim American Candidates.
Earlier this year, I was assigned to cover the Hamtramck City Council. They were going to convene in January, and it was a remarkable moment because the city council would become a Muslim American majority city council. And based on a November election, the top vote getter was a Yemeni immigrant, a Muslim American man who got his citizenship several years before. In doing that story, several weeks later, I was also following the campaign of a Muslim American immigrant from India who was trying to seek a seat in the state legislature in Illinois. Following his campaign for a couple of news reports, I realized that there's this phenomenon out there that there are Muslim Americans in an environment nationally that could be considered hostile towards them, mm-hmm. are still seeking political office in the United States despite the deck, so to speak, being stacked against them. And what does it take to get through that? What does it take to overcome some of those obstacles? What does it take for these candidates to be successful? If anything, when you watch this program, I want you to understand that these are Americans just like you are, just like I am. Because they might be of a different religious faith doesn't mean that the circumstances that they want to help or change or make a difference in aren't the same as us. Mm-hmm. But perhaps unfairly so, they have a different set of circumstances that they have to overcome that many other candidates don't.
Were these candidates who were born here in the United States, or did they immigrate here?
None of the candidates were born in the United States. They are all immigrants. Mm-hmm. Saad al-Masmari is the Hamtramck City Council member. He is an immigrant from Yemen. Ilhan Omar is a Somali refugee who fled Somalia, resettled in a Kenyan refugee camp before coming to resettle in the United States. Mm-hmm. Harish Patel is an immigrant from India who came to the United States with his widowed mother when he was a teenager and had to learn English. Jesse Spey is an immigrant from Jordan who came with his parents when he was also a teenager and had to also acclimate to the culture and the society and the language. And so and all of them have not just the fact that they're immigrants, but they're also Muslim Americans. and they are also running in a political environment that right now is charged with a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the constituencies that they were running in. Did they have perhaps large support from other immigrants? Were there American citizens who had been there a long time? And what were some of the things that they were trying to convince voters about?
The most dramatic example of this is Ilhan Omar. She is 32 years old, and she is living among the Somali community in Minnesota. There's about 25,000 Somali Americans that live in Minnesota, particularly in Minneapolis. Most of them are refugees. They are growing in large part of the landscape now in Minnesota. She was running in this race against another Somali American man and the incumbent in the position, who was a 40-year, tenured legislator, Phyllis Kahn. It's a very liberal district. There are some Somali Americans that live in the district. There's a lot of students. Mm-hmm. It's a diverse group of voters. The irony in all of this is that in her primary election in August, in the end, Ilhan Omar did not win the Somali American vote. That went to the male challenger, mm-hmm. Mohammed Noor. But she did get enough votes from the Somali community and enough votes from the student community and a diverse body of voters that she won the general election, beating those other two candidates, because she spread out and appealed to a wide range of voters outside of her diaspora and outside of the traditional people you think might vote for her.
The documentary, Kane, I presume, is available at voanews.com for anybody to see.
That's right. Faith and Freedom, The Journey of Muslim American Candidates, I hope, is an interesting and previously untold aspect of American politics that I hope those who watch it might learn something from.
Kane, you are out in the field so much, it is a rare privilege to have you in our studios here. Thank you.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here to talk to you.
So much for you to check out at voanews.com. You've been listening to International Edition. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama recently signed a presidential policy directive that encourages further engagement between the United States and Cuba and the people of our two countries. He called the directive another major step forward in our efforts to normalize relations with Cuba. This process of normalizing relations with Cuba began under President Obama in December 2014. Since then, the United States has reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba, reopened its embassy in Havana, facilitated authorized travel, and launched initiatives to help cooperation and innovation between the United States and Cuba. In support of the President's policy of engagement with Cuba, the Departments of Treasury and Commerce have issued six sets of regulatory changes to facilitate additional authorized interactions between the Cuban and American people, including through authorized travel and commercial opportunities and greater access to information. The newest set of regulatory amendments that took effect on October 17th allow Cuban and U.S. institutions to engage in joint medical research and authorize greater collaboration on the testing and commercializing of Cuban drugs in the United States, meaning that Americans will increasingly benefit from Cuban pharmaceutical discoveries. In addition, the Commerce Department rules now authorize online sales of certain consumer groups to Cubans for personal use under a license exception. These amendments, said U.S. Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker, will create more opportunities for Cuban citizens to access American goods and services, further strengthening the ties between our two countries. Even as ties with Cuba are expanded, President Obama acknowledged that challenges remain and very real differences between our governments persist on issues of democracy and human rights. But engagement, he said, remains the best way to address those differences and make progress on behalf of our interests and values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials. Thank you.